Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. It is the end of the third quarter, which has been a good one for financial markets, even with significant volatility. On today's CIO Strategy Snapshot, we will take stock of the U.S. economy and financial markets heading into the fourth quarter, as well as cover other geopolitical matters top of mind for investors. So joining us for the conversation today, glad to welcome back Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office, Jason Dreho. Jason, there is, of course, plenty to cover. Maybe let's begin outside of the U.S. and spend some time on China. Now, it has been the big story in financial markets over the past week, with policy announcements triggering rallies in Chinese equities of over 20% in just a week. So with that, Jason, what has been announced? Why is it important? And what does it mean for Chinese equities from here?
This comes on the heels of stronger than expected policy stimulus from the central bank, which included cutting interest rates, cutting mortgage rates, providing sort of better support for investors, a variety of investors, to be able to engage and buy equities to support the Chinese equity markets. And just even so, overnight, we had the Chinese central bank said it would reduce mortgage rates for existing home loans by the end of October. So a lot of different measures that are being announced. I'm not going to go into all the different details, but there's clearly significant. Now, one thing that is kind of the open question for the markets is, is this a game changer or not? Is it a big kind of the bazooka that's really going to be the real clear pivot point, or is it another kind of false start or false dawn in terms of the policy implications? Our view within CIO is that ultimately a fundamental turnaround will likely require additional fiscal support for the property market. So there needs to be kind of fall through execution and not just kind of commentary and words. So there is scope from the financial markets perspective for equity to continue to re-rate, to give some perspective, just in the, over the past week, including today with the Chinese markets already closed for the day on Monday, major Chinese indices are already up over 20% just in that roughly 6-day time period, almost close to 30%, depending on the index you're looking at. It's led to a significant re-rating of Chinese equities, their valuations. So again, just a couple of weeks ago, the forward multiple, like the 12-month forward multiple for Chinese equities, for the MSCI China index, was just below 9 times. Now it's at 10.5. That's a sizable movement in a very short time period. But for perspective, that multiple had a valuation peak this year, back in May, at about 10.7 times. And the post-pandemic high was reached in January of 23 at 11.8 times. So there's just kind of reaching those levels provides scope for Chinese equities to continue to go higher. But the reason why there might be a little bit of caution for investors is that we've sort of seen comparable moves before in the Chinese equity markets. Just this year, back in April and May, of about a 4-week stretch, Chinese equities were up 20% on the hopes of some policy easing. And then in late 22, when there was talk of China reopening, they did eventually reopen very quickly, and Chinese equities rallied 60% from essentially the beginning of November of 2022 through late January of 2023. So sizable moves. And at that latter move, when it did peak out, it was around a 12 multiple. So again, some scope for Chinese equities to move higher. It also suggests, we found kind of the floor for Chinese equities, given the policy responses, that a pullback of 20% would sort of indicate the more aggressive action will be taken. So there is signals of how much pain that the Chinese policymakers will tolerate for the property market, equity markets, and clearly they've taken measures. From a global investor perspective, I think there's still going to be some caution about jumping into Chinese equities wholeheartedly. It's clear investors globally, were underinvested, and that's why you saw short covering, some really significant moves in a short period of time. Not unlike what we've seen in U.S. equity markets earlier in the summer, when small caps were up 12% in the matter of a couple of weeks, a lot of it due to kind of short covering and position adjustment. So some of the move we've seen in Chinese equities the past week reflects that position adjustment. But similar to, again, the small cap position earlier in the summer that rallied, a lot of investors kind of viewed that as a trade. They still have concerns about the fundamental strength of the U.S. economy. Similar, I think, in China, the policy response clearly has moved the markets, but the fall to an execution will be the key to really have investors believe in this time is the bazooka, the game changer. And I think until we see that, especially going into the U.S. election that's only, you know, roughly now 5 weeks away. There'll be some sort of trepidation. And just in the very near term, China's entering a holiday period, the Golden Week, that begins actually on Tuesday. So you'd see Chinese markets closed. So a lot of movement up into then, and then it's going to get a little bit quiet. So we're going to lack some, you know, some signals and additional information from China for the rest of this week. In terms of what we do recommend for our, you know, U.S. clients, you know, there's selective opportunities that we still feel are more tied to kind of global themes, including things like adding kind of exposure via leading internet names that are going to be less tied perhaps to the policy response, but have a kind of the secular story that, you know, that should also benefit them. So, you know, cautiously adding some exposure or opportunities in China, but, you know, just be conscious that, you know, for a lot of investors, this is a trade and this is not a fundamental repositioning. And therefore, like the past couple moves, this could ultimately peter out within a month or so, unless the Chinese policymakers really do follow through with this continued strong execution and not just kind of reiterate, you know, their intentions to do significant action.
Thank you for the positioning guidance and for keeping our listeners current on what has been taking place in China. If we come back to the U.S., the economy is entering Q4 in good strength, but there is still some concern about the labor market. This is leading up to the September jobs report, which we will receive on Friday morning. So a lot going on this week with respect to jobs data. What will you be watching out for, Jason?
Well, the labor market really is the key focus. You could say for the Fed, even though they say their risks are balanced, in some way they're probably putting more emphasis on the labor market cooling, given that the most recent inflation data is showing they're very much on track to meeting their kind of their targets for the end of this year and for the end of next year. Likewise, for the investors, a lot of good data in terms of the economy overall, that it looks like the economy is still growing at trend, if not above trend. But what we're seeing is a labor market that has cooled throughout the year. And the concern is that since it is a lagging indicator, that perhaps the labor market will continue to cool despite the Fed now cutting rates. And if it does cool, it could ultimately kind of not just cool, but crack. And if it does, that certainly significantly increases the recession risk. So that's why, you know, this jobs report that will come out, you know, on Friday for September, similar to the prior month, it is, you know, will be very, very closely watched. The consensus forecast right now is for 145,000 new, you know, jobs based on the payrolls data, with the unemployment rate staying roughly the same, around 4.2%. For perspective, the August payrolls report was 142,000, and then back in July, it was around 112,000. So 145 would show, you know, continued sort of stabilization of the job market. There is also the possibility that the August numbers will get revised higher. I mean, they could be revised higher or lower, as well as July. But August in particular has had a quirky seasonal pattern where I think from most of the past decade, the August numbers were subsequently revised, you know, higher. So if you get an uptick in August and September comes in, you know, at consensus or above, that will certainly alleviate, you know, some of the concerns that investors have about the job market. Before we get the payrolls report on Tuesday, October 1st, we will get the JOLTS job openings data for August. So it's a little bit lagging. We could continue to see, you know, job openings decline. That would be a further indication that the labor market is cooling. A big decline would further, you know, fuel concerns and put even more pressure on the payrolls report on Friday to kind of deliver a strong number. If we kind of look at the overall labor market picture and think about how it's evolved over the last 6 months, really the story is that hiring is moderated, but firing also remains, or layoffs remains very, very low. So initial claims that come out every Thursday, they've been actually trending lower for the past month after rising in July into August. So giving some reprieve to the concerns about the labor market. In fact, the most recent data point on Thursday for initial claims, it was the lowest reading in 4 months. So really, it seems like the labor market's in a bit of a holding pattern. Companies aren't necessarily hiring a lot. They're certainly scaled back hiring, but they're also choosing not to lay off workers. Waiting to see what happens with interest rates, waiting to see what happens with the economy. In that context, then I would say that for the financial markets, a jobs number at or, you know, above 150,000 would be kind of a good result that would further kind of alleviate these kind of labor market concerns and recession concerns. A number that's 100,000 or less would be, you know, viewed as bad because this would reinforce the view that the labor market is cooling rapidly. A number in the 100,000, 150,000 range would probably be okay by default. It's neither really definitively good or definitively bad. But the longer the labor market stays at that level, let's say, you know, in the mid 125,000 area, the longer it does that, while the Fed is cutting rates, I think investors will be comfortable that you're not going to get further weakness in the labor market because the benefits of rate cuts will start to filter through the economy, kind of stabilize where the labor market is. So that is kind of how the big setup this week. It could again be sort of a market moving event, but it also, as long as it's not bad, that's essentially kind of good for the markets from a medium to longer term perspective.
Okay, now continuing with the health of the U.S. economy with that macro backdrop in mind, there was recent data that led you to upgrade your likelihood of a roaring 20s outcome, which you actually wrote about in your most recent blog, that title, Coming Up Roses. So, Jason, what have you been picking up on? What can you share with us?
Well, this is a thesis, this kind of roaring 20s scenario that we've talked about multiple times on the podcast before. Of the economy, growing at its 2.5% or higher for an indefinite period, inflation staying contained in the 2-3% range, the rates, frankly, kind of in the range where they are, like the 10-year around 4-ish%, and the Fed funds rate ultimately falling down to 3.5%. But the key feature is growth staying elevated. To me, that this scenario to play out really requires positive supply side developments in terms of a CapEx spending, surge in AI investments, ultimately leading to faster productivity growth. But there are other parts of the story that could, lead to or certainly support this roaring 20 scenario. One is a strong aggregate demand. The other is kind of policy being sort of supportive. I think the news over the past couple of weeks to me are what sort of helped move the needle at least marginally more towards this becoming, almost a base case, but certainly becoming increasingly, probable that this could actually happen for an extended period of time. And for the, the consumer spending or the consumer side of this or the aggregate demand side of the story, the relevant data point that came out was last week on Thursday when we got the annual revisions to GDP, gross domestic product, but also GDI, which is gross domestic income. Both were revised. In particular, gross domestic income was revised higher when we go back to the last 5 years. So for some perspective, the real GDPI growth was revised up 1.3 percentage points for 2023. So that's a very sizable move higher. 0.7 percentage points for 22 and 0.5% for 2021. A lot of this had to do with higher kind of profitability, higher interest income. What it also did is narrowed or almost effectively limited the gap between GDP and GDI kind of measures. There had been a wide gap. GDP was strong, GDI was weak. If you want to look and construct the story of the economy, it's actually not nearly as strong as the headline suggests. You could have pointed to the GDI numbers to say, our income growth isn't that high, the consumer is weak, saving rates are very low, eventually the consumer is going to crack, this is not sustainable. This revision suggests, no, actually income growth was quite strong and robust, more than we assumed. And that was also a factor why the savings rate was revised significantly higher. So for example, in Q2, the prior estimate was 3.3% savings rate, now it's at 5.2%. Still below the 7% level that typically existed prior to the pandemic, it definitely provides also more scope for households to maintain that savings rate, but also increase spending now that real incomes or incomes are rising faster than inflation. What all this means is that households in aggregate, if you look at their kind of balance sheets or their financial situation, were in good shape in aggregate, whether you're measuring this based on the rise in total wealth, debt servicing costs, which were actually quite low because so many people locked in mortgage rates at very low levels, incomes were now rising. And what this tells us is that those kind of financial balance sheet was an even better strength than before. There are certainly pain points among the consumers. Lower income consumers are kind of suffering, but overall, this is a kind of a good kind of story of where you're telling us that households in general are in stronger shape. That means demand, consumer spending can hold up longer. I think that's incrementally positive for kind of growth going forward. On the policy front, the Fed, they cut 50 basis points. That was a pretty bold move. But I think for the roaring 20s type of scenario, the key point is that the Fed, to me, signaled a strong desire to preserve the soft landing and maintain full employment, even if it means that the progress towards getting to 2% inflation is going to be a little bit more gradual. The Fed would never come out and ever say that we will tolerate inflation above 2%. But to me, it's also a signal that maybe the Fed would let the economy run a little bit hotter in order for the labor market to get really tight. You go back to 2016, former Fed Chair Janet Yellen essentially made that comment that if they can have positive benefits for the economy if they get a tight labor market and pull people back into the labor force. And current Fed Chair Jay Powell in early 2021, said one of their goals was to have a broad-based and inclusive recovery for the labor market, not just full employment. So if you kind of look at some of these breadcrumbs, to me, it indicates that you have a Fed that is going to tolerate or actually want to see the economy kind of run hot. And if that's the case, again, that's kind of consistent with this roaring 20s scenario. So to me, all told, the demand story, the consumer story, and the policy news over the past couple weeks is positive. And really what it does is sort of buy time for ultimately these kind of supply side developments, positive supply side developments to actually kind of kick in, which we think they will, or there's a good chance they will. But you add it all up to me, this is a kind of a positive, you know, dynamic or development that would be suggested this roaring 20s regime that we're frankly currently in, this could continue for a number of years down the line.
Okay, so with that, Jason, perhaps we can wrap up with the markets. Now, given all of the developments you've covered with us today, how should investors think about positioning as we're heading into the final stretch of the year?
Well, Dan, you began your intro comments by commenting how the, you know, the returns in the Q3 have been strong despite a lot of volatility, and that's true also year to date. You know, the total return to the S&P 500 year to date is 21.5%. That's a very good performance. It's kind of leading the pack. Other parts of the markets aren't up, you know, quite as much. And certainly it's been led by the growth sector more so than value, small caps, and international markets, whether developed or emerging, haven't done as well. But they're all up, you know, 10% plus year to date. It certainly got a boost from the, you know, Chinese equities and China policy response last week. We still see upside between now and year end, and also we think now, think about a medium-term horizon to next June. We have a price target of 6,200 for the S&P 500. So there is still upside, but, you know, valuations are stretched. I think it's a reasonable way to characterize it. A lot of good news is priced in. So just be kind of careful that, you know, disappointment in the labor market, election uncertainty, other geopolitical events that are going on around the world, they all have scope to, you know, to create volatility in the markets. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I think we, and if you look at market performance, it hasn't really pivoted towards a clear cyclical rotation in fits and starts here and there. But ultimately, we, you know, small caps, for example, have not outperformed since the Fed, you know, cut rates. So we have still have a bias towards kind of higher quality equities. Tech is a sector that we like it, you know, because it has quality, but also tied to secular themes are not as dependent on, you know, how the cycle is going to perform in the near term. You know, on the fixed income side, kind of similar story, kind of like quality fixed income. You don't need to take too much risk to get a lot of yield at this point in time, even with yields becoming lower. One thing we'd sort of recommend is that for those investors who should be starting to move out of cash, and given the Fed's cutting rates, the risk is that the Fed cuts even more aggressively than the market's, you know, pricing, if the economy slows down, then, you know, moving out of kind of cash, money market funds into quality fixed income, stay higher in quality. From a duration perspective, we think the 10-year, you know, it's considered to be in the range of 3.5% to 4%. But if the economic data is strong, remains solid, it's more likely you're going to see the 10-year drift towards 4% versus 3.5%. So kind of use any of those declines in bond prices and rising yields to be sort of entry points, rather than sort of, you know, chasing as the yields go lower, because ultimately we think the economy will hold enough to justify rates staying where they are, maybe just a little bit higher, at least in the very near term.
Well, Jason, very insightful conversation to begin a new trading week and a new quarter. Wish you a nice week ahead, and do look forward to picking back up with our conversation again next week.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.